netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. The FX Podcast is where we talk one-on-one with top visual effects artists doing cutting-edge work. We dig deep into the technical side, advance the craft of visual effects, and pay respect to the hardworking people creating amazing work. Be sure to check out all our other podcasts at fxguide.com/podcasts. What feels like it's been a while since I've done one of these. I hope you enjoyed our SIGGRAPH coverage. We had daily podcasts, written articles, and an FX Guide TV episode. Our Mike Seymour came over to the States from Australia to lead that coverage. Today, we're going to go on a visit with Mike to New Zealand's Weta Workshop and talk about the film Elysium. If you're interested in the film's visual effects, I would highly recommend our Ian Fales in-depth article on fxguide.com. He looks at practical, miniature, CGI, covering work by Image Engine, Weta Workshop, Whiskey Tree, Method Studios, ILM, The Embassy, MPC, Kerner Optical, and Masters FX. It's a really comprehensive article, unequaled coverage for this film. Really quickly, before we get to that, I wanted to flag that the new term is at the halfway mark already at fxphd.com. My picks this term have been Matt Leonard's History of Visual Effects, John Montgomery's Reluctant Sysadmin course, the Intro to Previs course, and I'm trying to get time to do a couple of new classes as well. Anyway, check out the full lineup over at fxphd.com. You won't believe the lineup of courses offered, and the price is too low to even mention. Truly the best and most affordable way to take your career to the next level. As I mentioned, Mike is visiting Weta Workshop, and we'll be speaking today with Rob Gillies, Workshop Supervisor, and Richard Taylor, who's the co-director of the Weta Workshop. Weta Workshop is part of Weta, and usually we're talking about Weta Digital, but Weta Workshop focuses on a range of disciplines, including concept design, weapons, armor, chainmail, specialist props, vehicles, specialty costumes, models and miniatures, special makeup and prosthetics, public art, and displays. So here we go. Let's join Mike Seymour speaking with Richard Taylor at the Weta Workshop.
Thanks, Jeff. Well, that's right. I visited Weta Workshop in Wellington, and later we'll talk to Rob Gillies. But first I sat down with Richard Taylor, Oscar winner, co-director of the Weta Workshop. And you know, you get this real sense in talking to all the team down there, how much they just genuinely loved working with director Neil Blomkamp. I mean, it was just, sounds like, an amazingly collaborative process, as you'll hear now from Richard.
Yeah, we were thrilled when Neil came back to us and talked to us about his next film after having worked on District 9 was one of those out-of-the-bag and rare moments in your career. So having Neil come back and invite us to be on the next one with him was beyond our wildest imaginings, which was cool. And then to have the movie so, that the film script to be so, thought-provoking, unique, creative, and then being asked to do so much. There's having a chance to do so much physical props and ideas. It's interesting because, of course, we're in a transitional period where a lot of physical effects are being realised digitally. And it's so neat working with a director that wants to use an abundance of physical props and having an opportunity to do bits of technology and sort of robotic tech that's actually on the lead actors is really thrilling for the team on the workshop floor.
Yeah, and obviously the director loved it to death. It features so prominently on the poster, for example.
When the poster came out, we were so delighted. Someone on the workshop floor said it's a poster for Weta Workshop, and it was just neat because for us, we take such pride in what we make, and then when a director shows it to that degree, it's really thrilling.
Talk to me about that relationship in establishing an aesthetic, because one of the things I really admired about District 9 is that the tech, while varied, seemed to come from the same era, the same technological kind of background or backstory. How do you go about establishing that?
It's something we pride ourselves here in the Weta Workshop design team. We call it world design, finding a cohesive ecology for all of the design of a particular culture or a world. And it's actually a very critical thing to give a plausibility to the cultural references in a movie. And whether it's an Avatar, a District 9, a Lord of the Rings, or a King Kong, and in this case Elysium, you have to give the audience the feeling that they're sitting in a period of history that has a cohesive design philosophy around it. And that was very much the case for Elysium. I do point out as well, though, that Neil himself as a director is also a very accomplished artist and creative thinker. And he himself offers a cohesive vision of these sort of ideas. So bring that to bear on the design team and everything they have to offer, and you really get a very tight and ultimately focused set of ideas within the movie.
Given how much you're involved as a team in that early design process, I mean, how do you even classify that work? Are you art department? Are you design department? What is it? Standby props? I mean, it's...
No, none of the above. We think of ourselves as a conceptual design team initially. That's conceptually exploring, because the other thing with Neil is that he's in no hurry to lock down on the defined design for his movie. He wants to explore it and explore it widely through the visual arts, and that's through ZBrush, Photoshop illustration, physical sculptures and prop mock-ups. So it's a really dynamic period of time that the team, that we're all involved in conceiving of those ideas. Once they're locked down, though, then we start the build. And we very much, in this case, are making specialist costume and props for the movie, most of them guns in this case. So some working firearms where we're actually building around real working gun mechanisms, other ones where we're putting specialist reciprocating mechanisms into our guns that we build here, and then just dummy guns, which are just rubber, a urethane gun that's just used for stunt work. So it's quite a variety of approaches.
Did it help tremendously in terms of production schedule to spend so long in that conceptual design phase so that you could very quickly not sort of waste time, I guess, with trying to sort of hunt down a look?
It does. You can't really do it any other way, because if you're trying to find the look in the build of the prop, it's both expensive and eating time. And by the time you start in pre-production on the actual build, time is often limited. So it's very critical that you have a very, very defined idea. Another benefit of working with Neil Blomkamp is that he is an incredibly skilled digital artist in his own right. So as we're riffing off him and he and him off us, we can not only send two-dimensional illustrations, but we can send fully realized three-dimensional models, which he then can add to, work into, or completely discard and do his own and send them back to us. Because it's one thing to have a two-dimensional drawing, but it's only from one degree of an angle. If you've got a three-dimensional object on the screen, it far more realizes the end vision of the object, the proportion, the size, the scale. And he, through his technical know-how, can bring that to bear on the process.
What were some of the references that you kind of looked to inspire the design work?
Neil has a great respect and love of historical sci-fi, if there is such a thing, you know, dating back into the early 80s, some of the incredible work that that was seen in movies such as Alien and the, you know, a lot of the great science fiction movies of the time. Of that particular time, which at some level, some of it can be a bit twee today when we look at how high-tech and beautiful the design work that is coming out of some of the new science fiction movies is. But it brings a personality to the design. And he's always looking for signature design. He's always looking for things that have a memorable quality to them. And so we draw on that influence. Obviously, we look at what is contemporary today and what some of the future thinkers are conceiving of when it comes to space flight, medical technology and such like. And then at the end of the day, you put all that to one side and it's what you can dream up in your mind. It does ultimately just come down to pure creativity.
They will hunt you to the edge of the earth for this. us.
Of course, one of the hallmarks of the work that you do is that things have had a life, that they have wear, that they aren't just sort of new and shiny and plastic. So in this film, I guess you're doing that both ways, right? Because in Up in Elysium, you do want bright and shiny and new, and everything else needs to be worn and pretty...
Yeah, we were definitely trying to create a contrast. And in reference to your original point there, you know, we live in a cluttered and damaged world. Humans do. Our world becomes worn out very quickly. The beautiful tabletop that you might buy from the IKEA store within a week gets the coffee ring. And it brings a texture and a lived-in quality to the world. And if you don't lay that over the films that you work on, the film at some level feels superficial and doesn't feel like it was occupied and inhabited. And even if you're in the future within a movie, of course, everything within the environment has already lived some life. So you might have the most high-tech vehicle, gun or prop, but if it's more than a week old, it's invariably now possessing of some aging. But in this movie, it's very interesting because the utopian environment that is Elysium has the ability to stay fresh and brand new constantly. And it's neat when you start to contrast the influences of time and age on the earthbound props and how they may be visualized on this incredible world up above.
How important is it for the conceptual design team to have a backstory versus something just looking cool?
It's critical for us. That doesn't mean it's critical for everyone, but for us as a design team here at the Weta Workshop, backstory is absolutely paramount to us. We will invent backstory if there isn't backstory, because if we don't do that, we can't believe in the material. We don't want to just work on things that are existing in the moment for a two-hour movie experience, because at some level the audience are then just viewing two-dimensional characters and images on a movie screen. The sort of the visual metaphor I draw for myself is that you want the audience to feel as if should they do this and look around the edges of the screen, the world would exist beyond the image that the director has chosen to show them, such as the validity and solidity of the world through a design process. And you could argue that's not critical for all storytelling, but it's something that we enjoy greatly when we're designing.
So the signature piece, we've already said because of the poster, the signature piece is the Hulk suit on his back. How quickly did that design come about, and how much was it something that evolved?
The Hulk suit is it doesn't actually look hugely substantial at a design level when you see it in the trailer and the poster. Neither should it have. It needed to look light, completely at one with the human body. But what's very interesting around the challenges making that object, it's one thing to draw it on paper, and the design team came up with that design fairly quickly. There is amazing technology happening specifically in the American military around power-assisted lifting suits. But at the moment, they're quite bulky and significant things. You can watch them on YouTube. Very, very cool. But they're certainly not going to make for fantastic dynamic visual images on a Matt Damon-like character as he runs around inside a movie. So knowing that Matt Damon would need to look nimble, dynamic, aggressive in the suit, it was critical that the scale of it was minimised. So in the case of our own bodies, we work because our skeleton is inside the volume of our bodies. And therefore, our shoulder joint and our collarbone works just fine because it's within the middle of the volumes that are moving. You now take the skeleton off out of the body and hang it on the outside, everything changes. Because a pivot that's here, when you put it out here, can no longer operate in the same way. And the Hulk suit became quite a complex and quite significant piece of design to get it to look as simple as it is. No more so than the spine, the way the back of the neck works, the way the shoulder blades work.
So one of the things we've heard is that the suit ended up being relatively lightweight, and but you must have had a real compromise problem there between producing something that looked cool and actually having something that an actor could act in.
We've always got that very difficult physical balance between making it look everything you want it to look, really cool, really dynamic, powerful, looking like it's made out of modern materials, while making it very, very light, so that the actor doesn't feel encumbered by it. It's a challenge that goes right through to manufacturing armour, whether it's medieval, contemporary or science fiction. It's always about making sure the performance isn't encumbered by the thing that's been worn. And then, of course, the big physical challenge is making sure it doesn't break. Because it's one thing to make it incredibly light, it's another thing to make sure it's very, very durable. And as you'll see in this movie, Matt Damon, being a very physical actor of incredible power and dynamic performance, puts it through its paces, thrashes it, basically. And you never want to provide a prop where the actor feels that their performance is compromised because they're having to coddle that prop through the length of the project. They're having to nurture it should it break. So our manufacturing techniques over the last 25 odd years has developed significantly. So really what we can promise is we can put a prop on set that, unless some very extreme actions happen, it's going to survive and get there, get through the shoot. Obviously supported by our on-set team that look after it so well.
So Richard, if you and I were to meet in 30 years from now, do you think such a suit would ever be practical?
I think a suit such as the one we designed will be a physical reality in 2 to 3 years maybe. No, maybe 5 years, let's say, because people are already doing significant things with it. There's a company in New Zealand that's doing power-assisted legs for people that are handicapped, and that technology is only going to continue to grow as we find more and more solutions for scaling down battery power, motive power, and amplifying that power. All of these things are going to benefit that level of robotic engineering. So I can't wait. Help me in my next time you have to dig a post hole to put a fence post in, you'll be able to put your suit on. And so it's a great dream at this point anyway.
Attention incoming vessels. You are in violation of Elysium airspace. Return to Earth, or we will be forced to take immediate action.
Standard warning didn't work.
What do you want us to do, ma'am?
10,000 kilometers and closing.
Shoot them down.
Missiles away.
Well, next we talk to Rob Gillies, workshop supervisor at Weta Workshop. In addition to the Hulk suit, which we've spoken about a lot and is obviously iconic to this film, Weta Workshop did an enormous amount of work on other things, such as the weapons, something I asked him about.
Yeah, there was a huge amount of weapons. So we went through and had a breakdown list for everything from handguns right through to assault rifles. We had grenades, we had helicopter-mounted assault rifles as well. So there was a lot involved in Elysium as far as the weapons went. We had attachments that we had on the front ends of AK-47s. And these were like augmentations to the weapons in that regard. But the brief was to actually make fully designed, practically working in the sense that they would fire particulates out the end and have a smoke effect coming out of the barrel, as well as the barrel reciprocating. And all of that needed to be condensed into the design. So some of the designs of the weapons were only about 40 millimetres thick, so extremely tight tolerances. But all the engineering, all the working gears on the inside all had to fit within that parameter. So a good brief, a challenging brief, and a lot of fun.
And, of course, you need to have a consistency of design across all of this stuff.
Yeah.
It seems like it's coming from the same world.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. So we essentially had about, I think it was 4 designers working across Elysium, and they basically honed in on Neil's vision. and came up with the majority of the designs for the weapons, the Hulk suits as well, and pretty much everything that that we'd have produced.
Tell me what the Hulk suit was made out of. Like, what was the actual material that was in the real world engineered out of?
Yeah, so we did a lot of reference, a lot of looking online for actual Hulk suits, which are starting to come into manufacture now. Obviously, they're made out of lightweight materials that are extremely strong. We settled on urethane, a product that we call CC60. And it's basically a 60 shore hardness urethane. And that's what we used predominantly for all of the linkages that run between the pistons themselves. So the pistons themselves are made out of acetyl plastic with essentially a dummy piston setup going on with elastic on cords. Essentially, it was as basic as that in the end. But we tried to design the suit so it had full mobility, full movement. Nothing was restricting and could perform full stunt action as well.
Was it the pistons that gave it the ability to stretch to accommodate the fact that obviously it's pivoting a joint outside the actual centre of an arm?
Yeah, that's right. The actual geometry, I guess, of the Hulk suit was technically very challenging to allow full range of motion on the human body. You know, the body's an amazing thing with the human skeleton on the inside of the body surrounded by muscles and tendons, but once you extract that to the outside of the body, it becomes a whole different affair. So all the pistons, the linkages, all need to work together in synergy, essentially, so that no matter what action the actor is performing, he's getting a full range of motion. So essentially his back was probably the most challenging piece as far as the linkages and pistons were concerned. Just in the way there were so many pieces all intertwining with each other, it all needed to move in harmony and not bind each other up, not lock each other up or lock the performer up as well.
How specific did the suit have to be to Matt Damon's actual dimensions and physicality?
Well, we actually got a body scan of Matt Damon to start with, so we built the suit around his frame, which was extremely helpful. So it needed to fit him extremely well. So his stunt performers, we also custom fit to the stunt performers. And Sholto Kruger as well, we fit specifically to his body scan.
So I'm guessing that you want to make the suit as lightweight as possible, but
yeah,
the last thing in the world you want to do is fall off in a take.
That's right, yeah.
Ruin a performance. Talk to me about that sort of line between making it incredibly robust and therefore durable, but
yeah,
sort of not restricting the actors.
Well, I guess because we had the body scan data, we were able to custom make this thing. Now, actually picking up into the body as the design aesthetic of the actual suit was the intention behind it was actually drilled into Max's skeleton in the film. So that presented a challenge in itself. So we went with the idea that we had a lycra undersuit with little pickup points and essentially screw heads that we could screw into from the Hulk suit. So we designed an entire undersuit with these little pick points all over it strategically as to where the pistons were going to fall, and then literally screwed into those to give the illusion that it was going through clothing. When it came to the skin, I think there was only two places on his arms where we actually needed to bandage the wounds to try and hide that, so it wasn't so obvious that it wasn't actually penetrating through his skin, but still giving the illusion that it was.
And did the suits perform? I mean, how many, for example, suits did Matt Damon actually go through while filming?
We produced six suits in total for the Max character. So that was two for the hero, two for the stunt, and two extremely soft stunt suits for high falls and that sort of action. So we had an on-set team, and they just ran constant maintenance on those six suits. Same setup for Sholto as well for Kruger.
And how long would it take to fit a suit on one of the lead actors?
I think the guys got it down to about 20 minutes on set, the dress time. So they got it down really quickly, and those dress times usually come down. So they usually start up being about an hour by the time you actually figure out how to get the guy into it and how to make him comfortable. And then from there, you can just work on shaving those minutes off to try and get the dress time as quick as possible.
And to that end, was there any kind of revision after the first day, or by the time you got to principal photography, you really had everything down pat?
By the time we got to principal, we had the Max suit down pat, so the hero suit down pat, but then we had to work on the stunt suit. Now, it was kind of interesting. The suit, because it was made out of plastics and urethane, it wasn't so much injury to the actual performer wearing it that we were concerned about. It was more if he interacted with somebody else, if he grappled with somebody else, how badly was he actually going to injure them wearing this external shell? So hence we went ahead and made a very soft stunt suit. So when they were doing grappling scenes, there wasn't any chance of injury or of the character Max injuring the person that he was actually fighting.
So tell me about, apart from the suit and the weapons, what else you did in terms of the production?
We did a lot of really cool gags. We did a lot of sort of surgery gags. We had one shot where the character Max gets an implant in the back of his head. And so for that we had a full body cast of Matt Damon. It was a face-down rig, and we actually extracted a piece of his skull up the back here and made that a removable component out of the dummy's head, built an internal brain from the front so they could actually use a little grinder, grind out a piece of his skull, extract that piece out, and then pop the piece of electronics equipment inside his brain. So that was extremely fun. We did a lot of prosthetics as well, a lot of tattoos, a lot of scars, wounds, citizens' barcodes. Yeah, so...
And when did you guys first get involved with the project? Because you were a long design process, right?
Yeah, it was a huge design process. So 2011, I guess. Yeah, it must have been. Yeah, 2011. I remember being in the heat of it in August. So I think we went through about a 4 month manufacture on the floor, and then probably about another 6 months to 8 months of design before that.
Because some of the principal photography took place in, let's face it, less than ideal kind of locations.
Yeah, that's what we heard. Yeah, apparently one of the largest landfills in Mexico, which sounded interesting. Yeah.
But we had to get the all of the props and all the gear to work reliably, like all of the time.
Yeah, we try to build our props so that under any circumstances, under any conditions, they're going to hold up and they're going to perform well. It's actually a lot harder for me in my position now to reprogram my team here on the workshop floor to actually make BG or differentiate between hero quality and background quality, because the level these guys work to now is just exceptional. Everything needs to be A double plus sort of delivery quality. So it's extremely difficult for me to actually get them to lessen that for a lower end item. So generally our product just comes out as good as it can be.
Well, thanks so much for taking time to talk to us. Really appreciate it.
Yeah.
Well, thanks to Weta Workshop, and don't forget to check out our extensive written story at FX Guide by Ian Fales. It's a cracker of a piece. And Jeff, in a couple of weeks' time, we'll be exploring even further into the actual workflow of the digital assets on Elysium with our friends at Image Engine. I'm heading off to Canada.
Well, thanks, Mike, and that trip means I'll get to see you soon, which is always a good thing. I found the discussion about backstory for props and story so interesting, especially in light of some of the conversation on the internet lately. Kathleen Kennedy made a comment at a Star Wars event in Germany. She said, "The conversation we're having all the time now about Episode 7 is, how much CGI? We're looking at what the early Star Wars films did. They used real locations with special effects. So we're going to find some cool locations. We're going to end up using every single tool in the toolbox." Well, online, this kind of got turned into a conversation about not using CGI, which is not how I took it. I took it as trying to get away from green screen and using as many props and physical things for actors to react with. Anyway, she went on to say that some fan pieces had amazed her, saying, "Using model makers, using real droids, taking advantage of the artwork you can touch and feel. We want to do that in combination with CGFX." I was talking to some friends of mine, and we were talking about how when we moved to CGI for a lot of things that were previously the domain of models, we did that not only because CGI became good enough to pull it off, but it also became cheaper than physically building and filming models. What I love about places like Weta Workshop is the involvement in making those determinations, picking the right approach for each scene. So I want to mention that everything we do on FX Guide is available to you online, searchable. It's quite a wealth of visual effects information, and the only thing we ever ask for you in terms of support is that you consider becoming an FX Insider for $49 a year. FX Insider is our membership program that offers insiders exclusive access to content and expanded article. We just posted a piece from SIGGRAPH on technology shown there for rehabilitation, a suit that aids in body movement and strength lifting. And we contrasted that to Weta's work on the suit like that in Elysium. The video is available exclusively to FX Insiders. It's a way for people who care about visual effects and the work that we do here to help us continue and grow. Details, fxguide.com. Click the FX Insider tab. You've been listening to the FX Podcast. We also produce two other regular audio podcasts. The VFX Show reviews visual effects in current releases, as well as dipping back into classic films. And the RC Podcast covers the ever-changing landscape of digital cinematography. Also, as I mentioned earlier, FX Guide TV, our high-definition video podcast. You can find all of these, along with in-depth articles, news, and more, at fxguide.com. Also, check out our sister site, as I mentioned earlier, fxphd.com, for online visual effects training. Well, that'll do it for this episode. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, this is Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX Podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.